Welcome to the 423rd meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests here today, and to our public radio audience, reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Point Lookout Conference Center in Northport, Maine, and I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 as a citizens' forum for study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies. We are now in our 36th year of monthly meetings featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. To listen to past forum presentations, to find out about upcoming forum programs, and to learn how to become a forum member, visit our website at midcoastforum.org. Today, we are very pleased to have with us Professor Gregory Gauss, who will be speaking on Saudi Arabia. Is it a reliable ally? Professor Gauss is the John H. Lindsay 44 Chair Professor of International Affairs and head of the International Affairs Department of the Bush School of Government and Policy Service at Texas A&M University. He was previously on the faculties of the University of Vermont and Columbia University, and was Fellow for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. During the 2009-2010 academic year, he was Kuwait Foundation Visiting Professor of International Affairs at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. In the spring of 2009, he was a Fulbright Scholar at the American University in Kuwait, and in the spring of 2010, he was a research fellow at the King Faisal Center for Islamic Studies and Research in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. His research focuses on the international politics of the Middle East, particularly the Arabian Peninsula and Persian Gulf. He has published three books, most recently, The International Relations of the Persian Gulf, published by the Cambridge University Press in 2010. His articles have appeared in Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, Middle East Journal, Security Studies, Washington Quarterly, National Interest, and other journals and edited volumes. He received his PhD in political science from the Harvard University in 1987, and his Bachelor of Arts degree, summa cum laude, from St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia in 1980. He studied Arabic at the American University in Cairo and at Middlebury College. Greg, a warm welcome to the Midwest Coast Forum.
Thanks, George. Thank you very much, George. I'm from Texas A&M University, and at Texas A&M University, we start every event with a rousing howdy. Thank you. Any Aggies out there? No Aggies. No Aggies on the Midcoast. I would like to use the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi dissident, opponent of the current crown prince, but also Saudi insider, last year as a window into the changes that are occurring in Saudi politics and policy. I think we have a tendency since the killing of Jamal Khashoggi to see all of Saudi Arabia and all the issues in Saudi Arabia through the lens of the young crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. But the context of Mohammed bin Salman's rise, I think, will give us some understanding of his ambitions, his irresponsible actions in many cases, and what he would like to do in the region, and why his goals and his ambitions in some ways are running sideways of traditional American goals in the region, but maybe are exactly what the Trump administration wants to see. So let me take you back not so far to 2015, when King Abdullah, the previous king of Saudi Arabia, dies, and the current king, King Salman, the father of Mohammed bin Salman, becomes king. He appoints his young son as defense minister and second deputy prime minister, that is to say, the guy, the third in line. You know, they've got a crown prince and the king, and Mohammed bin Salman is third in line. So what did this new administration, if you will, in Saudi Arabia face? Well, in 2015, if you recall, oil prices had collapsed. They were down around $30 a barrel. And at $30 a barrel, Saudi Arabia really could not sustain the welfare state that it built over the last decades that was part and parcel of the Saudi regime's ruling bargain with its own population. And so at $30 a barrel, there was a need for serious rethinking and serious redoing of the political economy of Saudi Arabia, something that that's never easy to do anywhere. It's first. Second, 2015, the region was still seeing the after effects of the Arab uprisings of 2010-2011, right? The collapse of regimes in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, and Syria, the continuing civil wars in Yemen and Syria and Libya. And the fact that even before 2011, Iran had been taking advantage of the collapse of state authority throughout the Middle East to strengthen its position, not just in Lebanon and in Syria, and to some extent in Yemen, but also, probably most importantly, in Iraq, where, as a result of the American invasion of 2013 and the deliberate American policy of destroying the state in Iraq, the Iranians were able to develop what is, I think, pretty widely acknowledged to be the dominant position of influence in Iraqi politics now. Finally, in 2015, as King Salman and his young son come into power, there were demographic realities in the Saudi family itself that had to be faced. Saudi Arabia had been ruled since the 1950s by a series of brothers and half-brothers who had succeeded the founder of modern Saudi Arabia, King Abdulaziz ibn Abdulrahman, who was known in the West as Ibn Saud, the guy who put together modern Saudi Arabia in the first half of the 20th century. And ever since his death in 1953, Saudi Arabia had been ruled by a series of his sons. He was quite prolific. He had, you know, over 50 sons. They don't count daughters over there, so I don't know how many of those he had, but over 50 sons. And those sons had been basically passing rulership, kingship, along, if you will, a horizontal line for 65 years. But the demographic tables were catching up with the family, and there weren't that many of that generation left. And at some point, rulership was going to have to go to the grandsons of the founding king. And so in 2015, King Salman and Mohammed bin Salman, his young son, who was his right hand, faced a political economy crisis, a series of foreign policy crises, and a demographic crisis, if you will, within the family itself. And it was facing those issues that this very ambitious and headstrong and somewhat irresponsible young policymaker, Mohammed bin Salman, was given very wide latitude by his father to institute changes throughout the country in all of these areas. I want to talk about very briefly four areas where Mohammed bin Salman has attempted to change Saudi Arabia, whether for good or for ill, is something that we can talk about in questions. First off, the political economy. Right? Mohammed bin Salman was given carte blanche by his father, the king, to institute what they would call economic reform in the country. Now, this was encapsulated in a document that Mohammed bin Salman rolled out in 2016 called Vision 2030. Right? Vision 2030 had as its goal the reduction of the role of oil in the Saudi political economy, and the development of non-oil sectors of the economy with an eye toward trying to increase the role of the private sector and the role of the private sector in employing Saudis. Right? Saudis overwhelmingly work for the government. 90% of the Saudis in the workforce work for the government. And the private sector in Saudi Arabia is overwhelmingly dominated by foreign labor. Tended to be cheaper in terms of wages than Saudis, and easier to control by the private sector. Now, the steps that were suggested in Vision 2030 were not new. They had basically been in every economic plan in Saudi Arabia since the 1970s. It's just because they imposed pain on people, no one had really implemented them. And Mohammed bin Salman did. Right? He started by cutting subsidies. Right? Saudi Arabia had some of the cheapest electricity, the cheapest water, the cheapest gasoline in the world. Right? Part of this deal to the citizens to make life easy. But of course, that introduced all sorts of inefficiencies into the economy of Saudi Arabia. Right? People leaving their houses for the summer and just keep turning up the air conditioning. What did they care when electricity was so cheap? But this was not only costing the Saudi state money, but it was affecting the course of the economy in that all of these resources had to be poured into sustaining these subsidies. Mohammed bin Salman increased the price of gasoline and electricity and water, and he introduced a tax, a value-added tax, a sales tax, right? The first direct tax instituted in Saudi Arabia since the oil boom of the 1970s. All of these things had been on the recommended list from outside consultants and economic specialists on Saudi Arabia for decades. But Mohammed bin Salman is the first one to do it. He also instituted policies that vastly increased the cost of foreign labor, right, in terms of the price of visas. And this has led, among other things, to the exodus of nearly a million foreign workers from Saudi Arabia in the last 3 or 4 years. Right? There are about 8 or 9 million foreign workers in Saudi Arabia, and about 1 million of them have left in the last 3 or 4 years. Right? But the core problems in converting the economy in Saudi Arabia and lessening the role of oil remain. The private sector is still built on a business model of cheap foreign labor. The domestic labor force still prefers that nice, cushy state job. The fact that oil prices have bounced back from $30 a barrel in 2015 to over $60 a barrel now means that the wolf is not exactly at the door, maybe in the backyard, but not at the door. And thus, the willingness of the population to accept the costs of this profound change that Vision 2030 set out is probably less than it was at 2015, and thus there's been some backtracking from these reforms. And finally, the impatience of the Crown Prince doesn't help. Right? That impatience was reflected in November of 2017, where basically he arrested the economic elite of the country and put them in the most luxurious jail one can imagine, the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh, and kept them there. Right? In some cases for days, in some cases for weeks, in some cases for months. While, according to the Saudi government, the ill-gotten gains of this private sector were removed from their pockets and given back to the state. Now, one can argue about whether this was justified or not. Many younger Saudis thought that this was a good thing, thought that these people had been ripping off the economy. But one thing is clear. These elements of the private sector in Saudi Arabia thought they knew what the rules were and were playing by the rules. And this new young guy is changing the rules. Now, if you want the private sector to take a greater role in developing your economy, perhaps not the best thing to do is to change the rules without telling them. Right? Capital's a coward. Right? Capital is a coward, whether it's international investors or domestic investors. And if you believe that you don't know the rules under which you are operating and you are not going to be able to take your profits out of your investments, right? Because at any moment you could be thrown into the Ritz-Carlton, you are going to be reluctant to invest. And this, I think, has been a serious problem for Mohammed bin Salman, and remains one going forward in terms of economic change. Secondly, on foreign policy. One can argue that Mohammed bin Salman was a bull in a china shop in foreign policy, taking Saudi Arabia into areas where it hadn't been before and acting much more aggressively. But I would say that the changes actually started with the Arab uprisings of 2011. The Saudis became much more activists, right? Intervening in Egypt to try to destabilize the Muslim Brotherhood government there and then supporting the military coup. Intervening in Yemen, although not militarily, before 2015, to try to bring about a change in Yemeni politics that would be comfortable for Saudi Arabia. And as you can see from the map there, which is not going to help our radio audience, but as you can see from the map there, that was a joke, Yemen really is Saudi Arabia's backyard, and that's the way Saudis think of it. It's not the way Yemenis think of it, but it's the way Saudis think of it, right? And the Saudis are neuralgic about any other power gaining a foothold in the politics of Yemen. And thus they see Iran's involvement in Yemen, which is not enormous. It's not like Iran's involvement in Iraq or Syria. But they see Iran's involvement in Yemen as a grave threat. And so it wasn't Mohammed bin Salman who'd started focusing on Yemen, but it was Mohammed bin Salman who, in alliance with the United Arab Emirates, introduced the military intervention into Yemen to try to bring about a conclusion to the civil war that would support Saudi allies there and block the pro-Iranian group called the Houthis that had taken over the capital at Sana'a and was moving down toward Aden on the coast of the Arabian Sea. But there is a recklessness in the way Mohammed bin Salman has conducted foreign policy. In November of 2017, he invited the Prime Minister of Lebanon to come and visit Riyadh, a longtime Saudi ally. And he basically kidnapped him and forced him to resign, right? Hoping to create a political crisis in Lebanon that would hurt Hezbollah, right? The Iranian ally in Lebanon. This completely backfired on MBS. And the Prime Minister, Saad al-Hariri, returned to Beirut, not only strengthened politically, but more beholden to Hezbollah than even he had been before. MBS and his allies in the United Arab Emirates also declared a boycott on Qatar, a monarchical ally, a member of the Gulf Cooperation Council with Saudi Arabia. Right. The Saudis and the Emiratis didn't like that the Qataris were supporting Muslim Brotherhood movements and were kind of the odd man out among the Gulf monarchies. But an economic boycott of a country that has the highest per capita income in the world is probably not going to be very effective. And in fact, this split between Qatar and its former monarchical allies in Saudi Arabia and the UAE continues and places the United States in a difficult position. Because, of course, the United States has close relations with Saudi Arabia and with the Emirates, but America's largest air base in the Middle East is in Qatar. So the Qataris have the best lobbyist in Washington on their side, and that's the Pentagon. I think the problem for MBS is he really doesn't appreciate the limits of Saudi power in foreign affairs. His uncles, who governed the country for 50 years before him, and even his father, lived through lots of crises. They lived through the crisis of Arab nationalism and Gamal Abdel Nasser challenging the Saudis. They lived through the Iranian Revolution of 1979. They lived through 9/11. They realized, they felt, I think, in their bones, instinctively, the limits of Saudi power, and they were cautious in foreign policy. Mohammed bin Salman, born in the 1980s, coming of age in the 2000s, didn't experience those crises in Saudi foreign policy. And I think he has an inflated view of Saudi power. Third area where Mohammed bin Salman is shaking things up is social life. And here he has achieved major changes that I don't think we can underestimate their importance. Right? Women driving, right? That was one thing that everybody knew, every American knew about Saudi Arabia, two things, right? They knew that 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudis, and that bin Laden was a Saudi. And they knew that Saudi Arabia was the only country in the world where women were not permitted to drive. Now, I've been going to Saudi Arabia for 30 years. And in that 30 years, everyone I knew in Saudi Arabia said, This country's ready for women driving. It's just our politicians don't want to take the risk. They don't want to be the one in front because they fear there might be some backlash from the religious. But everybody's ready for women driving. Mohammed bin Salman was the one politician in Saudi Arabia who basically grabbed that issue, cut the Gordian knot, said, yeah, women can drive. Now, I don't think that we can underestimate the social and economic importance of this. If you want to move Saudi women into the workforce, they got to be able to drive to work. There's not that much public transportation in Saudi Arabia. Right? They got to be able to drive to work. One of the reasons why so many foreign laborers have left, right, is that even middle class and lower middle class Saudi families basically had to hire a driver to get the women around. Now they don't have to do that. I think that this is going to have a very positive long-term effect on Saudi economic and social life. The Crown Prince is also opening up social life in terms of movie theaters and a bit more public entertainments. And in doing so, he's trying to reduce the role of the clerics in Saudi social life. Now, there's going to be backlash to this, there's no question about it. But as of yet, we haven't seen that backlash develop. And he is shepherding in changes that appear to be very well received among Saudi youth and that are at least being accepted by those parts of Saudi society where perhaps one might have anticipated more of a reaction. The fourth area, the final area where major change is occurring in Saudi Arabia is within the royal family itself. As I mentioned, for the past 50 years, up until 2015, Saudi Arabia had been ruled by a horizontal line of brothers and half-brothers who succeeded to the kingship, right? And that demographic chain was running out. But even more importantly, I think, than the demographics of this were the style of rule. Saudi Arabia was, it's a monarchy, it has a king, but it was basically run by a committee. It was run by a committee of senior princes. And the king was the first among equals, right? A strong king would have more say. A weaker king would defer more to his brothers and half-brothers who were, right, in these important government positions. And Saudi rule had all of the negative elements of committees. It was slow. It was ponderous. It couldn't take advantage of opportunities as they emerged. Right? It was cautious. But it, on the flip side, it had all the advantages of committees. Stupid ideas tended to be put down, right? Unreasonable expectations tended to be tempered. Caution might be a bad thing in some circumstances, but it's a good thing in other circumstances. And so that committee framework for ruling Saudi Arabia had actually helped the Saudis weather all of these challenges and changes that had occurred in the region. Now, lots of people who follow Saudi Arabia, including myself, thought that, in essence, the next generation of Saudi princes were going to recreate the committee system that their fathers had run for 50 years. And it really looked like that was happening because a lot of sons were inheriting their father's positions. Right, in various cabinet ministries and other parts of Saudi Arabia, the Saudi Arabian government system. And it really looked like we were going to just recreate the committee system with a set of new faces. That's not what King Salman and Mohammed bin Salman had in mind. The king basically, from 2015, turfed out his first crown prince, who was a younger brother of his, and made as crown prince Mohammed bin Nayef, who was the minister of the interior. Right? The next, he was a member of that third generation. His father, Prince Nayef, had been interior minister since the 1970s. And when he died, Mohammed bin Nayef took over the interior minister. Salman made him crown prince. Not only that, Mohammed bin Nayef was America's favorite Saudi. Because as Minister of the Interior and as his father's deputy before that, after 9/11, he became the point person for American cooperation, intelligence and counterterrorism cooperation with Saudi Arabia. And the Americans loved him. Right? He was cooperative, he was effective, he got things done. Right? This was bipartisan. The Bush 43 administration loved Mohammed bin Nayef, the Obama administration loved Mohammed bin Nayef. And so his appointment as crown prince was something that many people in the US said, this is a good thing. Not only are the Saudis getting over this demographic logjam and going to the next generation, but they're appointing a guy who is experienced, who we know, Washington knows, and who'll do a good job. This inspires confidence. Then 2 years later, King Salman turfed him out and made his young son, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, vaulting him over numerous of his cousins who were older and more experienced. And not only did the king vault his young son over those cousins, but he basically took those cousins out of their government jobs. Mohammed bin Nayef, no longer Minister of the Interior. King Abdullah's son, Mitib, who commanded the National Guard, he was fired in November of 2017 and given a room in the Ritz for a while. Other senior members of that generation who had held governorships, important governorships, and cabinet positions have lost them. Right now, Saudi Arabia has fewer members of the Al Saud family in cabinet positions than at any time in its modern history. And power has been concentrated in the hands of the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. Now, one would assume that this would not please his older cousins, and that there would be some reaction within the family to this radical change in the way politics was done. And in fact, there is a lot of grumbling about Mohammed bin Salman in family circles. However, I see no real sign of an effective coalition forming within the family to try to block the crown prince from conducting policy and eventually from becoming king. Unless that kind of coalition actually forms up, there really will be no obstacle to the crown prince becoming king when his father dies. And so that consolidation of power is, in many ways, I think, the most radical change that's happening in Saudi Arabia right now. It's happening kind of away from the headlines in the newspapers and kind of away from our public view, right? Because who has time, except for people like me, to follow this stuff? But I think it actually helps to explain this turn in Saudi policy, foreign policy that we see, right, away from caution and toward a more reckless approach to regional affairs. So, can the United States play the role of a restrainer on Mohammed bin Salman? Well, there's a problem here. And the problem is that the particularities of the Trump administration and the different approaches of the Trump administration to American policy in the Middle East generally, right, I think militate against Washington playing that restraining role. Right. To some extent, the Trump administration is not as concerned with regional stability to the same extent as past administrations. Right? It's willing to change American direction on Middle East issues, whether it be on Arab-Israeli issues, like the movement of the embassy to Jerusalem, or whether it be on issues of domestic political developments in the Arab world, where at least in the past we paid lip service to ideas of democracy and human rights. Now we don't even do that. And where, in contrast to the Obama administration, which had tried to engage Iran, the Trump administration has been particularly vocal in confronting Iran, withdrawing from the nuclear deal, And in just in the past few weeks, as we've seen, the rhetoric has ratcheted up, and the deployment of American forces in the region has increased. And so in that sense, the Trump administration is kind of on the same page as the Saudis, as the Saudi crown prince. But even more specifically, the Trump administration, more than any previous American administration, openly involved itself in the politics of the Saudi ruling family. The Trump administration did not hide its preferences for Mohammed bin Salman in terms of his rise to power. And in fact, it was just 6 weeks after President Trump's visit to Riyadh, his first foreign trip as president. Normally, American presidents visit either Canada or Mexico as their first visit, but of course, those are two hostile countries who are our enemies now, so we don't want to visit those places. So Saudi Arabia was the first trip, and Mohammed bin Salman's accession as crown prince and the turfing out of Mohammed bin Nayef occurred just about six weeks after President Trump's visit to Riyadh. No one in the Middle East thinks that's a coincidence. This would not have happened in a previous administration, where, as I had mentioned before, Mohammed bin Nayef was seen as an extremely reliable and a seasoned partner. Right? If this had happened in either the Bush 41 or the Obama administrations, and some young prince in Saudi Arabia had come to them and said, hey, I want to get rid of Mohammed bin Nayef and move up myself, I think that either of those administrations would have said, just wait your turn. Mohammed bin Nayef's a good guy. He's going to be a good king. But in the Trump administration, there was an open willingness to intervene in Saudi domestic politics. And if you look at the New York Times headline, not on the front page, but on one of the inside pages, for those of you who still read the thing, on paper. After this change, the headline was, Trump gets his man. The White House bragged about their role in helping Mohammed bin Salman become crown prince. And thus, that open embrace of him has linked the Trump administration to Mohammed bin Salman in a way that's hard for the Trump administration to back off of. And so the hopes of the United States acting as a restrainer on some of the less cautious and more irresponsible foreign policy actions of Mohammed bin Salman is, I think, much less than it would have been in any other administration. For 2 years, we did not have an ambassador in Riyadh. The Trump administration didn't appoint one. And when it finally did appoint one, General John Abizaid, former commander of Central Command, who I think is a good choice to be ambassador to Saudi Arabia, the confirmation process in the Senate took, as it always does in the Senate, way too long. Ambassador Abizaid just reported to Riyadh a couple of weeks ago. But the fact that 2 years went by, 2 years in which we not only saw the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, but we saw the boycott of Qatar, we saw the kidnapping of the Prime Minister of Lebanon, we have seen an inability to bring the Yemen war to a close. I think, I don't want to say if an American ambassador had been in Riyadh during that time, all of these things wouldn't have happened, but at least now there's a hope that there's someone in Riyadh with the confidence of the president, one hopes, who can speak directly to the crown prince about what America will support and, more importantly, what it can't support in terms of Saudi foreign policy. We'll see if that change occurs. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Now we're going to make you stand up here and
stand
answer
up here.
Questions,
okay.
Too. So,
I'm fine with that.
Thank you. We're going to gather questions, and while we do that, I'm going to take what I usually do, and that's the prerogative of the person doing the moderating to ask the first question. You talk about Saudi Arabia trying to reduce its dependence on oil, and what are the chances it can really reduce that dependence, and what other instruments of power do they have
to substitute
for that?
So there's really no precedent for drastically reducing the role of oil in an economy like Saudi Arabia's that's so dependent on oil. And so we're on uncharted ground. Now, that doesn't mean that steps can't be taken to lessen the centrality of oil, but oil is always going to be central in the Saudi Arabian economy. They are the largest exporter of oil in the world. They have the largest known resources of oil that's recoverable under more simple technologies. We're not talking about fracking or the heavy oil in the tar sands in the Orinoco Valley in Venezuela or up in Canada, but easily accessible oil, right? Saudi Arabia is still the cheapest oil in the world to produce is from Saudi Arabia in terms of cost per barrel. The last commercially viable drop of oil that comes into the world market is going to come from Saudi Arabia because their production costs are so low. But as one famous Saudi oil minister once said, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. And the oil age is not going to end because we run out of oil, right? It's going to end because of technological changes and environmental changes and all sorts of other things. And the Saudis know that, and they have to think about that day. But the cost of a wrenching change, right, which would in essence say, you know, the benefits that we as a oil-producing government give to you, our citizens, right, we're stopping those. Right, pay world prices for electricity. Pay world prices for what? Pay local prices for water. Right, in the Arabian Peninsula, water is much dearer than oil. Don't count on that government job that your father and your uncle and your grandfather had. Go out and do something productive. Those kinds of changes can make people mad. And the last thing you want to do in an authoritarian regime is make too many people mad. And so I think that as long as oil is $60 a barrel, we're going to see a much more cautious approach on that. So what other elements of power do the Saudis have? Well, Mecca and Medina are, of course, the two holiest sites in Islam. And Mecca is the focus of pilgrimage for a billion Muslims around the world, and well over a million Muslims from other countries go to Saudi Arabia every year for the Hajj, for the annual pilgrimage. That does give Saudi Arabia a role in the Muslim world that is outsized compared to other countries. One can argue that role has had a negative effect in the world of Islam, and many Muslims think that, because the particular version of Islam in Saudi Arabia, Wahhabism, is very xenophobic and puritanical and narrow. But that is without a doubt an element of Saudi power. Oil magnifies that, but for many Muslims around the world, they look at Saudi Arabia as a Muslim country that works. And I think the attractiveness of the Wahhabi interpretation of Islam, what in the Middle East and Saudis themselves call the Salafi interpretation of Islam, from the Arabic word salaf, which means ancestors. So what they're saying is we preach and practice the Islam of the pious ancestors, right, from the earliest days of the Muslim world, and try to follow in the path of the Prophet as much as we can. That's also going to be an element of Saudi power going forward. But you're absolutely right. I mean, if we don't care about oil anymore, we, the United States, we, the world economy, doesn't really care about oil anymore, then we're really not going to care about this part of the world that much.
You commented on the Saudi support for the Wahhabi religious leaders. And here's a question of, will MBS continue that level of support and funding for the Wahhabi religious leaders, or do you see any changes in that as a result of the political changes in Saudi Arabia?
So Mohammed bin Salman has been reducing the role of the clerical establishment in Saudi social life. I don't think he can eliminate it, but he's been reducing it. In terms of the if you will, the export of this interpretation of Islam, I haven't noticed great changes in terms of like cutting back on the finances or things like that, but these budgets don't get published. There certainly has been a rhetorical commitment by MBS to walk back from the past kind of overlap of Saudi Arabia and this Wahhabi interpretation of Islam around the world. Now, how successful he's going to be at that, one wonders. And to the extent that he feels pressure from the outside, from us on human rights issues or the Khashoggi killing or other things, he's probably more likely to go back to relying on the religious establishment. But I think that we shouldn't overestimate the amount to which Mohammed bin Salman is going to try to draw back on the export of this interpretation of Islam. For me, if I were advising an American president or an American State Department on this issue, I would say, you know, it's probably a dead end to deal with the Saudis on this, but what we should be doing is dealing with the governments where these preachers are going. Well, why don't we help them kind of recognize this issue? And why don't we try to understand why this particular interpretation of Islam seems to have at least some audience in the world? And I don't have a great answer to that question right now, but I think that's actually maybe the first question to answer when we think about this issue.
Thank you very much. We have several questions here that are very similar, both in asking how MBS was able to take power against all of his cousins, and then whether that situation is going to be stable,
right,
or whether it's then going to break down and there will be a coalition.
Right. The Game of Thrones question.
Game of Thrones question.
Yeah. So he did it because his father, the king, was willing to push on that. His father, the king, gave him the political cover to do this. His father, the king, is the one who fired all these people. His father, the king, is the one who placed all of this power in Mohammed bin Salman's hands. King Salman was part of that ruling group, all right, for 50 years. And as the last member of that ruling group, even though he has some brothers left and half-brothers left, he was kind of the last of the founders of this system. And so he has a lot of clout, and he knows where a lot of the bodies are buried. And thus he was able, I think, to empower his son in a way because he had there was no one at his level who could check his power. He was able to empower his son. Now, the real last chance, I think, for opponents of Mohammed bin Salman within the family to coalesce will be when the king dies. Will they be able to coalesce and, in essence, say the family doesn't accept Mohammed bin Salman's ascension to the kingship? That's not impossible, but I think it's highly unlikely. It's highly unlikely for a couple of reasons. One, I don't see any public sign that kind of coalition is forming right now. And that's not the kind of thing you throw together in 3 days. Right? Now, perhaps things are going on behind the scenes that we don't know about, always possible. But I don't see the public manifestations of a blocking coalition forming within the family. That's one. Number two, Mohammed bin Salman has a reputation for ruthlessness, well-deserved. So it's dangerous. It's dangerous to take those steps. Third, all of the members of this generation, basically from the time that they were at their mother's knees, were taught that the greatest threat to the family is internal strife. Past Saudi kingdoms in the 19th century, what's called by the historians the Second Saudi Kingdom in the 19th century, collapsed because of internal infighting within the family. And in the late 1950s and early 1960s, there was a serious conflict within the family between then King Saud and then Crown Prince Faisal. That was eventually, it took 6 years, but it was eventually settled in favor of the Crown Prince, who became King Faisal. But that was a time period where lots of people in the family said, our rule is at risk if we fight each other. So there's been a very strong norm within the family since that time that you don't have public fights. And that combination of factors leads me to think that it's unlikely that we'll see that blocking coalition form.
Interesting. As you might imagine, there are several questions here on the role of women in the Saudi society and the changes. Do you think the system of women guardianship will change anytime soon?
So the guardianship system is basically in order to travel, in order to get married, in order to even take a job in some cases, you have to get if you're a woman, you have to get the permission of your male guardian, who's usually your father. But if your father's not alive, could be a brother, could be an uncle. There have been some efforts to whittle away at the male guardianship system, but in its major elements, it's still there. My guess is it will be easier to change that in law than it will be to change that in practice. This is the exact opposite of the women's driving issue. Right? The women's driving issue was easier to change in practice than in law. Saudi women were driving in the countryside and nobody cared, and they just were doing it. Saudi women were driving abroad, regularly and all the time, and had driver's licenses in Europe and the States. And so on the women's driving issue, the practice was way ahead of the law. But I think on the guardianship issue, the practice is actually will lag the law. And it is a socially conservative country. There's just no question about that. But I think that those changes have to occur if women are going to be integrated into the workforce in greater numbers. The female labor participation in Saudi Arabia is extremely low. I think the figures are less than 20% of the citizen labor force is made up by women. It might be closer to 10%. And if you're going to have economic growth outside of the oil sector, you need to engage the productive elements of your society. Women are better educated than men in Saudi Arabia. The universities are overwhelmingly majority women. Basically because, for the guys, you don't need a university degree to get a job. You go into the government, you're a driver, join the army, you get a job. So the women are better educated in Saudi Arabia. And if you're going to introduce them into the workforce, which is exactly the goal of Vision 2030, right, you're going to have to give them legal and social freedoms to be able to move around in the country to take a job. And so this is going to be, I think, a really serious issue going forward.
And then here's one on women driving. And why do you think MBS kept women driving activists in prison, even after allowing women to drive?
Right. Well, this is the
undermine.
Yeah. This is the kind of thing that I don't have a good answer for. I've never met the Crown Prince. I've met people who have advised him and who are around him. The picture that we read in the newspapers is the picture they tell me. He's headstrong. He might be a reformer on social issues, but he's not a reformer on political issues. He doesn't have a democratic tendency. I mean, he keeps power in his hands and does what he thinks is right. And the speculation is that in this big move to give women the right to drive, he wanted it made clear that this came from him, right? From his prerogative. He wasn't forced to do this. He wasn't influenced by Western opinion or by activists within Saudi Arabia. And so to reinforce that, he does this absolutely gratuitous thing of throwing some of the major women campaigners on this issue into jail. Now, a number of them have been released in the last couple of weeks, but that doesn't make, you know, that doesn't mitigate or erase the public relations disaster this caused, I think, not just in the West, but also at home. I mean, if you want to empower women in the workforce and in society, which he says he wants to do, why would you take women who had taken an initiative and make an example of them in this way? And it's a puzzle, but you know, I don't think that he is at all shy about asserting the prerogatives of rulership. And that includes, you know, teaching people lessons when he thinks they need a lesson.
I want to switch gears a little bit here. Obviously, there'd be a number of questions on the assassination of Khashoggi. How do the Saudi people feel about this assassination?
I don't get the sense that there's an enormous revulsion against this across Saudi society. Among Saudi elites, people who knew Jamal Khashoggi, I think that this had a much more profound effect. Because Khashoggi was not a dissident. He was not a, like a long-term dissident. He had been, in fact, a member of the inner circle of the Saudi elite. He had worked for the Saudi government. He had been an advisor to Prince Turki bin Faisal, the son of King Faisal, who was ambassador to London and then to Washington. Jamal was Prince Turki's press advisor. He had been hired by Prince Khalid bin Faisal, who's the governor of Mecca, to run a newspaper in Saudi Arabia called Al-Watan. Jamal's a journalist by profession. And it was kind of a path-breaking newspaper in Saudi Arabia from a very low bar. I mean, the Saudi newspapers were tightly government-controlled. But reading Al-Watan in the 2000s, you know, after 9/11, there was some loosening up. And reading Al-Watan in the 2000s was actually interesting. You could learn things about Saudi Arabia. There were criticisms of government policies. You know, never of the king, right? But criticisms of government policies. And so Jamal had patrons within the ruling family. And when he started criticizing MBS, he didn't criticize the system. He didn't criticize the family as a whole. He didn't say that he wanted revolutionary political change in Saudi Arabia. He was actually quite moderate in what he was asking for. And so I think that it sent a real chilling effect through the elites in Saudi Arabia. And that's been reflected in kind of the way people like me who engage with them on a regular basis have had to deal with our friends. I mean, I don't send emails to friends and colleagues in Saudi Arabia as much as I used to anymore. I usually go to Saudi Arabia every January in between semesters. I didn't go this January, not because I was worried about myself, but I just didn't want people I talked to get in trouble. And so it was, the chilling effect is more at the elite level than at the mass level.
Then how about with the U.S.? What has the killing of Khashoggi done to change the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and the way the U.S. is viewed by the rest of the world?
Right. So I think that the most important effect of this in terms of the longer-term U.S.-Saudi relationship stems back to President Trump's embrace of MBS earlier. Because the president has embraced the crown prince and kind of soft-pedaled the Khashoggi affair, Saudi Arabia has become more of a partisan issue than it has been in the past in the United States. This isn't the only Middle East issue that's become more partisan. I think U.S. relations with Israel have become more partisan as well, as Prime Minister Netanyahu kind of openly supported President Trump, openly campaigned against President Obama's Iran nuclear deal, and allied his government in Israel much more with the Republican Party. That's led to some Democrats perhaps being more willing to ask questions about the relationship with Israel, but that's still more bipartisan. I think on the Saudi side, a real problem for the Saudis going forward is that they have become so identified with President Trump that that Democrats see relations with Saudi Arabia as a partisan issue now. And I think all of the Democratic candidates are going to be much more critical of Saudi Arabia going forward. And that's not good for the Saudis, because at some point there's going to be a Democratic president. And Saudi Arabia has always been criticized by American politicians across the board in Congress for all sorts of things. Administrations, both Republican and Democratic administrations, have sought to have good relations with Saudi Arabia. But I think that this close embrace by the Saudis of President Trump, and we're going to see more of that. More of that's going to come out as the investigations continue. Saudi and Emirati money that went into the Trump inaugural committee, for example. We're going to learn more about that. And I think it's just going to lead more and more Democrats to say, if the Saudis want to pick the Republicans, well, when we get into power, they're going to feel it. So I think that the killing of Jamal and the Trump administration's muted reaction to it is just going to play more into this. But let me say one more thing about that. If Hillary Clinton were president, the rhetorical reaction to Jamal Khashoggi's killing would have been much different. But I'm not sure on the practical level that things would have been much different.
Very interesting. Thank you. Here's one on the question of how the U.S. government works in this area. How much involvement does the president have in Saudi foreign policy versus his advisors, including his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and will an ambassador, having an ambassador there, lessen the influence of the advisors?
I'll date myself now. That's the $64,000 question. Right. The Saudis and the Emiratis have established a back channel. I mean, this is no secret. Right? Have established a back channel to the White House through Mr. Kushner. And Mr. Kushner has developed a personal relationship with Mohammed bin Salman. One of the reasons that I think that the Qatar embargo has gone on as long as it has is because the governments of Saudi Arabia and the UAE didn't feel like they had to listen to Secretary of State Tillerson or Secretary of Defense Mattis when both those gentlemen were pushing them to settle this contretemps among American allies, because they had a back door to the White House. And if you have a back door to the White House, you don't have to give a fig about what the Secretary of State is telling you, because you don't think the Secretary of State speaks for the president. Now, if General Abizaid, if the Saudis determine that what General Abizaid says to them is something they can ignore because they can go behind him to Jared Kushner and get the president to tell them something different, then his effectiveness in Riyadh will be at zero. And so I think that if the administration really does want to put some restraints, you know, kind of establish the guardrails for what we want Mohammed bin Salman's foreign policy to be, I think that back channel to Mr. Kushner has to close down, and General Abizaid has to be the voice that tells the Saudis what the American government believes, and the president has to back him up. If that doesn't happen, he might as well come back home.
Do you think that'll happen?
Well, let's just say I hope it happens.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Then one final question before we close, and that's to ask you to comment on the attacks on the ships in the Persian Gulf that just happened, and whether the U.S. is so closely tied to Saudi Arabia that we would implement or take military action against Iran if we think they're the responsible.
So here's where we get the real tension in the Trump administration. And in this way, it's not that different than the Obama administration. Right? The last three presidential elections were won by the candidate who was more dovish on the Middle East. Right? Obama, McCain, that's pretty obvious. Obama, Romney. And Clinton, Trump. Trump was the one who said that our involvement in the Middle East, in Middle East wars, was stupid and a waste of money and our leaders are stupid, all those things, right? And I think this reflects a general feeling in the American public that we have been too involved in Middle East wars. But this is the tension, right? The president wants to talk a tough game but doesn't want to get involved in actual conflicts. At some point, somebody calls your bluff. I don't know if the Iranians are going to be calling our bluff anytime soon. They have their own problems. And I don't think they want to fight a conventional war against the United States, right? I mean, we have all the advantages in a conventional war. They want to fight an unconventional war, an asymmetric war, right? They want to fight a war in which they support groups in Iraq and Syria and Lebanon and Yemen to try to control the politics there. Right? They don't want to take us on head on. So when we read about these sabotage attacks on Saudi and Emirati shipping in the last day, I think first and foremost we have to wait and see just what we can find out about it, because we don't want to get dragged into something where we actually don't know if this was who did this and why. I don't want to recall, you know, too far back in our history about the bombing of the Maine and all those kinds of things. Not the bombing of Maine, but you know, thank heavens Maine is safe,
except from Canada.
Well, you know, far from Mexico, but you guys do need that wall, Canada, to protect you from our enemies there. But I think that, we got to find out just what happened, number one. Number two, I think that the Trump administration has been trying to goad the Iranians into some kind of actions that would legitimate a strong U.S. response, right? Secretary of State Pompeo made a surprise visit to Brussels today to see the European foreign ministers to try to get them on board with the maximum pressure policy on Iran. That seems to me to be the first option, because I don't think the Trump administration wants to get into a shooting war with Iran. And if it does, right, if we get to the point where we see American planes bombing Iranian targets and we see American ships bombing Iranian coastal targets, I don't think the reaction is going to be an all-out Iranian assault on the American Fifth Fleet in the Persian Gulf. But what I think we'll see is over the next weeks and months, you know, things blowing up all along the Arab side of the Persian Gulf, and attacks on American interests in Iraq, right, where the Iranians have enormous influence, and attacks in Lebanon perhaps geared toward Israel, because the Iranians will see the Israelis as being involved in this as well. The Iranians will respond asymmetrically, and we are less able to deal with that kind of reaction than with an open conventional conflict. But look, I don't see any winners from a military confrontation with Iran. I think it undercuts people in Iran that we might have a better chance of dealing with. We've already done that by withdrawing from the nuclear deal. We've undercut the people in Iran that maybe we had a chance to deal with. This was the Obama administration's long-term strategy, right? One could wonder whether it would work or not, but the Obama long-term strategy was you do this nuclear deal with the Iranians, you walk them back from weaponization, and by doing that in the long term, you strengthen the quote-unquote moderates, and that eventually these moderates might get more of a handle on Iranian foreign policy, and you can deal with Iran more in a state-to-state way rather than as a supporter of non-state actors. Now, that's a theory. I don't know if it was going to work, right? But it's a theory. The Trump administration abandoned that theory, and so the people who had kind of staked their political claim in Iran on let's sign this deal, let's improve our relationship with the United States and these other and European countries, and there'll be some benefit for that. They're already discredited. But, you know, to the extent that we push in Iran, it empowers people who want to do things that we're not going to like.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And before I let you leave the stage, we have the much coveted Midcoast Forum mug.
Oh, excellent.
For your coffee.
Excellent.
It's a small
thank you
little
so much.
Gift to you.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Greg, let's let you get rid of your...
Oh, yes, the mic.
Yeah,
it might.
I'm muting, but, you know, I'm always worried. Those stray comments.
Yeah,
incorporated into the...
Yes.